So my topic is preconception and pregnancy planning in inflammatory bowel disease. As we know, this remains a really important topic for our patients, given the fact that the peak incidence of inflammatory bowel disease overlaps with the prime childbearing years. We know that the impact of disease and the medications themselves on fertility and pregnancy is probably at the top of their minds, and Robin showed you the birds and the bees stories, but she could agree with me that a lot of parents, when we're talking about these therapies, they're less concerned about the efficacy and safety, and they just want to know whether or not their daughter, for example, will be able to get pregnant on these medications. That's like a big, you know, discussion point at 14. And to be very honest with you, in New York, as you can imagine, we have a very large Orthodox Jewish community. And the biggest question I get from, truthfully, the rabbi who will call us to ask if whether or not the IBD itself impacts fertility, and whether the medications impact fertility, and this is at any point during adolescence even. So it's a really important thing that we also as pediatricians need to appreciate. And obviously sexual health and sexual function is actually a big topic for both the male and female aspects, and next year we'll include that in the topics of discussion, because I think it's becoming a big part of how we optimize our discussions with our patients. Just as like a basic fertility background, as a reminder, that what we do know is at a top level, outside of the female UC patient who has undergone pouch surgery, the final actually creation of the J-pouch itself, or proctocolectomy where they've actually removed the rectum and had an endoleostomy, either one where the pelvic is dissected, there could be adhesions that are formed, and I'll show you some of the convincing data on the impact of J-pouch in just a moment. Otherwise, we believe that women with UC do not have any difference in fertility compared to age-matched controls. What I've begun to understand after, you'll see a slide in a minute of a group in Britain when they looked at their cohort, the number one predictor of infertility was age. So it didn't matter whether you had IBD, whether you had something else, even J-pouch, age was really the factor that drove infertility. And that women with Crohn's disease, we are looking into whether or not having active disease, and I don't mean that Crohn's is different than UC, but there have been some reports that women with very active CD have a decrease in their malarian hormone, where it talks about ovarian reserve. So the question is, does disease activity impact ovarian reserve? So because in our preconception clinic, we partner with the infertility group at Sinai, they do AMH levels on everybody that comes in when they're looking at infertility treatment. So we're actually looking at whether or not disease activity is indeed tied with AMH, because that may explain why we're having difficulty getting some of the women pregnant who have active disease. So we're looking into that aspect, whether inflammation itself impacts fertility. Because to be honest, every fertility study has been retrospective. You know, they haven't looked at disease activity. They've looked at live births, for example. And this is one of these that looked at actually live births to actually declare fertility rates. So when you look back at a database that has diagnostic codes as well as actually deliveries in their medical database from the National Health System in UK, they actually showed indeed that if you look at age tends to whether you have, this is non-IBD patients, and these are patients before IBD surgery of any kind and after surgery. And if you look overall here, you can see that after surgery had a drop in the actual live birth rates. But you can also see that a woman after 35, whether you have IBD or not, there was a significant drop after 35 in fertility. So if when I have a 37-year-old female who has undergone J-pouch surgery, I'm not telling her to use the World Health Organization definition of infertility, which is come back in a year, right? You're not going to use that where you have to have, you know, sexual intercourse at the time of ovulation for a year before you declare someone infertile. So you do adjust your communication with women depending on age as to how much you want to go right directly to assisted reproductive technology and have them see our reproductive technology group. This is Jay Pouch, and this is what really was striking. This is the same database where they could look at every IBD patient as well as every surgery they've had, and that's where they found the age relationship. But this is pretty impressive that in a UC patient who has not had a pouch but has had surgery, or sorry, IBD patient, there's a slight drop in fertility, but you compared to control. So IBD overall, there's no drop. It's a adjusted fertility rate of 0.97, which is as close to 1 as you can get. The lower you are from 1, the higher the rate of infertility in the way that they designed this study. So in non-pouch patients, even though it's a 14% drop, the confidence interval crosses 1, so it was not significantly different when it came to actually statistically. But as you can see here, same could be said for patients who've undergone pouch surgery. Overall, they had a slight increase. This is before surgery. Patients, funny enough, it's above the control group, and people were saying that women who knew that they were going to have a J-pouch went and had as many babies as they could before the actual surgery. So maybe, even though, again, it doesn't cross 1, these patients were a little bit above the normal control population. But let's focus on after bowel surgery, and let's focus on when they've been able to document that they're they're off contraception, which is really the time that obviously is more important. This is when you're actually trying, probably. And what you can see is that after surgery, there is a 57% drop in fertility rates in women who've undergone a J-pouch. So this is a very important distinguishing that overall, when we communicate to our patients, I do bring this study out as probably one of the more common ways that I communicate for drop in fertility. Now, do I tell them they can't get pregnant? Absolutely not. Do I tell them that their uterus is fine and they can have a healthy baby? Absolutely. So it's really about how you're telling them that you're not going to try too long. We're going to look at whether or not you have adhesions or not. We're going to do salpingograms to look at the fallopian tubes a little bit sooner than what would standardly be done in a woman in her 20s, for example, if I again had that 37-year-old pouch patient. So this is a number you must remember, that in non-pouch, there's a non-significant drop, the confidence interval cross 1, but definitively post-pouch surgery, this is where the action begins in terms of documenting infertility. So does the fact that perhaps this takes into account open surgeries, open J-pouches, which is historical, and laparoscopic? And a lot of the critiques of the older studies that showed fertility was reduced in pouches, most notably the Olsen study, which is one we quote often before we got this British data, it actually said it was even before the era of laparoscopic surgery. So the group in Amsterdam who are very active, William Bimelen is one of the surgeons in Amsterdam, and they publish along with one other group in Europe. They actually look a lot at whether or not the advent of laparoscopic surgery changed the fertility rates, such as were the proportion of patients who eventually were able to get pregnant. It may take them longer, but they eventually had a successful pregnancy. Compared to people who had open J-pouches, you can see that it flattens, meaning they don't increase their ability to get pregnant. So that's the other key message that I tell women who've undergone surgery, is that in the era of laparoscopic, it may not be at a year that you're as successful as a woman who hasn't undergone a J-pouch, but over time you have a higher rate of likelihood of getting pregnant. So these, again, are small numbers. None of them are prospective. A lot of them are questionnaire-based, so this is actually like probably one of the largest areas that merit further exploration and need to be done in the current era of laparoscopic surgery. So in terms of one of the other big changes that have happened in the preconception discussion with our patients is that the FDA changed the way new drugs will be labeled. They also gave old drugs a 5-year period where they have to get themselves together and change their labels. So category A through X you will still continue to see in the majority of drugs that we have now, and they've got 5 years to adjust their label. What the label is now going to look at, it actually looks at pregnancy, lactation, and even talks about reproductive potential, whether or not the drug itself actually impacts fertility. And so this will be more helpful to discuss patients, and particularly, for goodness sakes, the OBs who are stopping thiopurines, as an example, because the data will be there to say, you know, and what our clinical data shows in pregnancy, in lactation, and reproductive health. So we're hoping that that's going to actually change practice in terms of how people view these therapies in IBD. But just to remember that there's a 5-year, it just happened, so we've got till 2020 before we start to see the changes in both our president as well as the FDA category. I'm kidding. I'm in Texas, so I am a blue state person, so I have to state that up front. So this idea that this will come in an era where we will be changing and new drugs that come to market, which will be about 2020, 2022, they will have to have the new label distinction. So I think we'll see more drugs being determined to be safe. So in the new era of labeling. But probably one of the biggest questions that everybody has is the drug that I'm going to use, actually, is there any data to support that there's congenital malformations in any of the babies born? Well, there's been a lot of work over the last 3 years trying to look at it in multiple cohorts where you have data as well as you have access to medication exposure. And in terms of all IBD, UCC, it doesn't matter. When you looked at any major congenital anomaly, there is no increased risk of IBD alone, right? Because there was a discussion. There was Jason Dominus who reported a long time ago in AJG that having IBD alone was associated with congenital malformation. So these studies have shown that IBD alone is not associated with congenital malformation. What about the common drugs we use? Prebiologic discussion on the drugs. 5-ASAs, corticosteroids, immunomodulators. To be honest, all of them crossed one in their confidence interval, and therefore there was not felt to be an increased risk of congenital malformation. Probably the biggest one is obviously the one that is still labeled as category D, which is the immunomodulators or thiopurines. And what we know is that the congenital rate with thiopurines, looking at big databases, have been shown to be exactly the same as the normal population, which is 3-4%. So there does not appear to be an increased rate of congenital malformations with thiopurines. And that will be reflected as the category determination will change, because category D will be removed from the label. So that will also help. That human data will help inform the labels moving forward. So probably the one that has received the most press and the one where patients are most interested is whether the era of biologics has been introduced. Not only has the era of biologics allowed women to get pregnant who couldn't get pregnant before, that's probably one of the most important discussion points, is that because we got you better, more women were able to actually get pregnant. So that was a plug for controlling inflammation. But the idea was what do we do with these biologics? If we don't find that they have any congenital malformation association, do they impact if they do cross the placenta? Because they're IgG1 subclass, just like when you give vaccines or Ig immunoglobulins, the mom's immunoglobulins provide protection over the first 6 months of life. These are the same immune globulins. So if they cross in the third trimester, these drugs are crossing. If those natural immune globulins cross, these drugs are also crossing. And you could see that as you head towards the 30th week of gestation, then there's an exponential rise up. So in 2006, we first realized that this is actually happening because we measured it in a baby of a colleague of mine who was working with me at the time. Her child was exposed to infliximab during pregnancy, and there was a report that TNF causes lymphoma that had come out. Her main concern was that the baby was going to be at risk for lymphoma. That was the discussion at the time, and she wanted us to check the baby's blood for whether or not the baby had any infliximab in her blood. And when we tested the baby at 4 weeks post-delivery, the baby had more TNF in her bloodstream than the mother did. So that was the discovery, that there was a preferential passage of TNF, and we thought it was the breast milk. of course it was the breast. In our minds, you know, we had no idea because the label did not have any discussion on placental transfer. Lo and behold, she stopped breastfeeding for just a very brief period of time. She said, forget it, I want to breastfeed. She continued to breastfeed, and despite breastfeeding exposure to the baby, the TNF levels dropped to zero. So we realized that it was all tied to placental transfer, and that was how it happened. So a decade ago, it was really just in my practice communicating with my patients, and she happened to be in the room, and that's how the discussion started. So the idea is that if there is placental transfer, how do I manage this aspect of stopping and, you know, when do I stop? I'm worried about immunogenicity. Is it safe to stop? So Uma and myself published this in 2013, and we made some very broad statements about TNF exposure and stopping, recognizing that a lot of it was just our own experience more than it was the fact that it's dogma. There's no wrong answer right now in terms of stopping, and we have a little bit more data that I'll show you in just a moment. But when we first discussed it, we said infliximab, we noted that in all cases, the cord blood level was higher than the mom, and so we know that infliximab tends to have higher levels. We showed that in adalimumab, that even though we stopped adalimumab even up to a month prior to delivery, I just want you to know that even 4 months, there was still cord blood. So the idea that stopping it at week 34, which is something we're advocating, and I may even show it on a slide, makes absolutely no sense, just for your information. So after we figured out that even the half-lives of these drugs are so long that if you really, really don't want drug in the cord of the baby, you have to stop it around week 20, 22. So the idea is there enough risk-benefit discussion to say, I'm going to stop it, let's see what your IBD does, and restart it if you flare. That, of course, is difficult in a woman who needed TNF to get pregnant. So right now, what I'm telling you is I'm just continuing therapy. That'll be my statement at the end. But there is some negotiation with the mother in the third trimester, to be quite honest, because there's always negotiation with our patients with TNF, and imagine in a pregnancy state. So really where the where I'm a little bit more kind of tough on it is that during the first two trimesters, I really want you to stay on drug because I don't want preterm deliveries and I don't want spontaneous abortions. That is the number one risk of stopping therapy and having inflammation. Once you get into the third trimester where there's a lot of progesterone, which is actually a very strong anti-inflammatory, and if you ask women, they tell you they've never felt so good in their lives than in the third trimester. And so that's where I'm a little bit, you know, there's a negotiation that can occur. And, you know, the ideal fact that, for example, vedolizumab, ustekinumab, and infliximab are given at an 8-week interval if patients are still on that, it allows you to give it around week 32 and then give it right after delivery. So there is, again, a little bit ease. The aspect of adalimumab, which is either weekly or every other week, does become a little bit more complicated, and I'll show you some data on what adalimumab does during third trimester anyways. And of course, there was everyone knows that when certolizumab came out, the discussion was is that because of the pegylated nature of the molecule, it couldn't bind to the Fc receptor on the placenta, and therefore there was no crossing over in the third trimester, or at all, actually, throughout the three trimesters. And so the idea was, in a woman of childbearing potential, two things come up. One, would you preferentially choose certolizumab over other therapies that we can discuss at the discussion? And two, should you change somebody who's stable on another anti-TNF? And as you're shaking your head, absolutely not. So the idea did come up, though, when this story first came out, is, well, if it's safer and it doesn't cross and we're worried about all the effects of the TNF on the baby, we should be switching. And obviously that's not the right answer, and we can, again, talk to it. And I see the questions are popping up on this iPad rapidly, so it's good. I like to generate discussion more than anything. This is what the group in Calgary, so Rima was a big part of this, and Rima, you can correct me if I'm wrong and interpreting it as a bottom line, is that small numbers, but what they found is that infliximab levels typically actually went up in the third trimester, and adalimumab levels, even when still giving it, went down. So there's a differential way that the mother is processing even the TNF. So what I've started to do is check a drug level in the second trimester and use the drug level to determine when I need to give if I need to give infliximab in the third or not, just because the drug level continues to rise. So again, we can talk about that. But around week 28, 29, I'm checking a drug level, deciding whether I need to give the woman another infusion in the early third trimester. So these are, again, discussion points, all new, and I'll ask Remo to comment on what Cynthia and his group are doing for these now that they've shown that the adalimumab levels consistently drop and the infliximab levels tend to stay up. So that's what, and they showed that the peak in the mid-third trimester and postpartum drop versus in adalimumab levels decrease steadily during pregnancy. What is the difference between these therapies? I actually don't know. Maybe he can fill us in on what magical thing is happening with infliximab in the third trimester. And this was another report from another group that was just published in Gastro, which I thought was very interesting, was they were looking at whether indeed there is a correlation between what the mom has in the blood at delivery and the cord blood, and this was showing quite a nice correlation between the mom and the cord blood. You could see the correlation values 0.82 being the highest, and so you can see that maternal concentration at birth, which is interesting, and then the number of weeks since their last infusion. So if they got an infusion 10 weeks ago, the drug levels were lower. If they got an infusion or injection 2 weeks ago, they were higher. So there was a nice decrease in terms of last injection, infusion, and maternal blood levels. So if you want to write down this reference, this is very nice because it actually shows that there's a very nice correlation between cord blood and maternal blood concentration of 0.8, which is a good correlation. And they actually tried to look at what week, if I stopped the anti-TNF, would I get less cord blood levels in the baby? And it looks like week 30. So even though we were guessing that when Uma and I were kind of going around town saying everything should stop at week 30, we're not so far off. It's actually pretty close. So we weren't kind of misleading anybody. And what it was really showing is that you get such, obviously, a much higher level in the mom's blood if you give it greater than 30 weeks gestation. And look at the baby's cord blood. It was 10, you know, so there was a much higher level in the baby if you gave it at 10 weeks, I mean, sorry, within 10 weeks of delivery versus 2.2 if you gave it less than 30 weeks. So take this message with you in terms of as you're counseling your female patients as to when the last contact with a TNF, last contact of TNF may play a bigger role in terms of when you actually decide the last infusion. This is nice. This is actually one of the better studies because it's the first time where they actually looked at if I gave drug before 30 weeks versus after. The good news is that we also looked at the ratio of maternal to baby cord blood, and what we saw is that infliximab does have the highest ratio, meaning the baby has 2.5 times more blood, more Remicade in their cord blood at time of delivery compared to the mom. Okay? That's the real thing. Adalimumab and ustekinumab, please keep it in mind that this was off-label, this was already collected, so I'm just telling you that's why the numbers are smaller for Stelara, because these were off-label use. But if you look at adalimumab, you can see that there is a lower ratio of cord to maternal, but that could make sense as the drug levels are dropping in the mom in the third trimester. With adalimumab, you get a lower level at birth. Veto is 0.7, so it looks like the mom has more than the baby. I don't know the biology of this, so we're going to try and figure out what veto is or is not doing at the placental level crossing. Forget natalizumab, and of course it makes complete sense that sertilizumab doesn't. So I think this is worthy of, if you want to take a picture, I'm happy for you to do it, but just or write the numbers down, because I think this is a really important conversation that you're going to have with your moms. But the good news is that even with exposure in the third trimester, and we looked at women who were exposed and stopped it before the third trimester, or those that got it within week 30, and we wanted to see whether biologics impacted any outcome whatsoever, and it did not. So the question is, if it does cross and we do continue it because we have a sick woman who is holding on to every 4-week Remi, it wasn't impacting the infection rates in the baby. So that's a very important also take-home point. And we looked at maternal immunomodulators don't impact vaccine responses. We also looked at whether or not different therapies impacted how a baby responded to vaccines, and it didn't look like any of the therapies we were using impacted vaccine responses. And by the way, this is from DDW just now, so this was just presented at DDW, so this is relatively hot off the press. And also, we were just looking at, this was a summary slides of pregnancy and IBD from DDW, so it's kind of an accumulation of everything. And we wanted to show you that there was, as we know, there is increased risk. This actually sticks with what's been reported, which we know 100%. There's increased IUGR, there's increased preterm labor, and increased preterm delivery compared to non-IBD pregnancies. We know that. But that is tied to inflammatory control. So the point is, if we can get inflammation under control, we can control the outcomes. And that is why communication with women about staying on their meds throughout the first two trimesters, which is so critical, and then the discussion on if the baby's growing well, maybe removing in the third trimester, but it's all about how the baby is growing. One of the probably the most other important slides that we found is, again, the fact that this was just showing you that, again, confirming that adalimumab levels are low during pregnancy. So this was confirming what Remo and Cynthia actually showed. So there's something unique about adalimumab and its concentrations. And probably one of the most important conclusions that we came out with Piano at DDW this year was that we looked at the development, meaning cognitive development in babies born prospectively to moms exposed to biologics and immunomodulators, and there was no association between drug exposure and developmental delay. And of course, our conclusion can't be that those babies who were exposed to anti-TNF were smarter, but I will tell you that did show that. But what I'm trying to tell you is that controlling inflammation, it has a positive outcome on cognitive and neural development in fetuses. So that is another reason for women to be clearly educated about why inflammation control is critical. And we know that from also the lupus space as well. Just a little bit on vedolizumab. We don't have much. We published it recently in APT, is that we looked at whether or not exposure to vedo impacts pregnancy outcomes or whether or not the baby has increased congenital malformations or spontaneous abortions, just to tell you that there's no difference from the patients, the control patients. But I should also tell you, when you look at data from a clinical trial, please remember that babies, that the moms had to stop the drug the minute they were pregnant. Therefore, this is not exposure throughout the entire three trimesters. Very important recognition that when you see publications from trials, the drug was stopped. So it's not really the whole story. The whole story is post-approval, and that's what we need. We need more data on what's actually happening when you expose the baby to the entire three trimesters. I have done, and I have data, that we don't have increased rates of spontaneous abortions or congenital malformations, but it's worthy of further investigation. We don't have the amount of babies like we do with the TNFs. Breastfeeding, conclusion is that these molecules appear very low at the nanogram level, if any, in breast milk, so we are actually advocating to continue breastfeeding with our biologic therapies. It does not, and this is just also a summary that we didn't affect, even back then when we first looked at breastfeeding, didn't impact development as well. And just as a reminder, Cimzia is not in breast milk, 1/20th of the maternal level in adalimumab, so very small levels, and the same for infliximab, and that was only in one patient. So I don't want to get too excited about that there was a nanogram level of drug detected. Timing of biologics, we just talked about that, but just as a reminder, if the mom flares, please treat her. The nice thing about having a preconception clinic with our high-risk OBs is that they tell us that the mother is the most important, baby will follow. Meaning if mom is healthy, baby will be healthy. A reminder, no live vaccines for the first 6 months if they were exposed to, I should update this, any biologic in the third trimester or during pregnancy. And the only one that would come into play is the rotavirus vaccine, because that's the only one given within 6 months of delivery. So that doesn't impact MMR or varicella. What I do want to end with is the importance of preconception. I could tell you that when you have preconception care planned, or you have someone in your community that is focused on managing women with pregnancy, and you have a high-risk OB that you partner with, I could tell you that the outcomes are significantly different in terms of their ability to stay on their meds, less smoking, higher folic acid use, less flares, and better outcomes for the baby. So this was actually a study that they actually, our colleagues in the Netherlands published, and they were just showing that they do have a preconception model, and patients are followed if they're in remission. They stay on their medication regimen. If they're not in remission, you need to tell them to strive for remission preconception. being in remission at conception will shape the entire pregnancy. So we really want to get women before they are planning pregnancy to explain the importance of inflammation control, and this is just their protocol, and you can find this in their publication. But what they did show, as I noted to you as well, same as what we're showing, is that we're really getting better outcomes in everything we're measuring when we have the women come to our, we call it IPREP, which is IBD, Preconception and Pregnancy Planning Clinic, and I'm sure Remo could talk about what they're doing also in Calgary, because they have a significant interest in preconception as well. And this is just showing you that there was actually better birth outcomes in women and better, less low birth weight, which is very important for babies' cognitive development to be of normal development, birth height and weight. So method of delivery, just as a reminder that if you have active perianal disease, that is the only contraindication to vaginal delivery. Everything else is up for negotiation. And I think it's really dependent on you, the OB, the high-risk OB, the colorectal surgeon, if a woman has had a J-pouch, if the woman's already having incontinent issues, you're probably going to want to do a C-section. If the woman is going to have 10 pregnancies, you probably want to avoid a C-section because you don't want 10 C-sections. There's a lot that actually goes into the discussion every time when you're making the decision. But active perianal disease, no discussion. Everything else is up for debate and discussion. I'd love to answer questions. So just as a reminder, pregnancy requires a team approach. You must actually focus on the entire picture of getting them pregnant. Inflammatory control is your number one priority. Do whatever it takes to get inflammation under control. It will improve conception. It will improve baby's outcomes. And don't wait a year based on the infertility definition if you have a woman who's had a J-pouch and is above the age of 35. That is a very, very important message. So thank you very much for your attention.